The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. I'd like to start with a word of prayer, so let's bow our heads. Heavenly Father, we pause before we study this wonderful world of mathematics and ask your blessing upon what we do. May we always be seeking truth. May we always be seeking you in our endeavors. Even this morning as we look to see how we can improve as math teachers, would you work in our hearts and pray these things in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. My name is Brett Edwards. I teach at Atlanta Classical Christian Academy. I'm going to do a session on the seven laws of teaching mathematics. When I submitted this session months ago, I thought it was kind of a clever take on the book John Milton Gregory's The Seven Laws of Teaching. And then I was looking through the sessions in the past of the ACCS conference, and this has already been done. So I'm just going to stop here, refer you to the website, and save you guys some time. But I think it was back in 2006. Did anyone go to that lecture? All right, so I'm safe. But John Milton Gregory wrote a book called The Seven Laws of Teaching. Can I see hands? Who's read that book? Okay, that's great. I've read it two or three times now, and it gets better every time I read it. But I think we as math teachers specifically need to think about how this applies to our realm, teaching mathematics. So that's what I'll be doing. I'll be covering a lot. I'm going about 700 miles per hour today. That's kind of how I do the seminars. I don't get to see you guys every day, so I go a little slower in my class, obviously, but I'll be doing much. If you get lost or want to go back to something, please email me. My email address I gave up there, and I'll give it again at the end. But email me, and I'll give you a link to online where you can get the notes and all the stuff. I've placed some quote-unquote excursions throughout this talk. I just enjoy looking at the wonderful world of math, historical situations, different problems, different paradoxes. So I've tried to intersperse those that relate directly to the material I'm teaching. This book, The Seven Laws of Teaching, I think gets at the very core of the acquisition of knowledge for our students. How do students really attain knowledge? And I think this book gets at it, and that's why I've wanted to look deeper at how this applies to mathematics. The first law that we're going to talk about is the law of the math teacher. The math teacher must know that which he would teach. And I have this cartoon here that I share with my kids sometimes, and it looks like Dad's going outside of the room. He says, yeah, homework helpline. I need to have you explain the quadratic equation in roughly the amount of time it takes to get a cup of coffee. So the idea here being he obviously doesn't know his material, but he's the dad. But we as math teachers obviously need to know our material. One thing you might, if you haven't read the book, you're going to hear some of these laws and go, duh. A lot of times, you know, they're pretty fundamental, basic laws. But it's really when he gets into the discussion of the law that we really see some fantastic principles that help us as teachers. The nice man may teach virtue. The nice man may teach honor, compassion, and courage, but this does not give him the ability to teach differential calculus. Knowledge is a word ill-defined in our culture. Gregory refers to four layers, okay, four layers of knowledge. The four layers of knowledge, the first one being recognition. Recognition is when you say, who can remember the quadratic formula? Who can remember the Pythagorean theorem? And if I write it on the board, they go, oh, that's that one. That's all it is. It's not even really being able to give it back to you. But they go, oh, that's the Pythagorean theorem, isn't it? Okay? That's the first layer of knowledge. The second layer is recall. When we recall a fact, so you can say it. Okay? You can actually tell it. Okay? Modern education, and I think modern math education, tops off at number two. What we do is we want to get recognition and recall, and boom, then we're done and we move on to the next concept and idea. I believe a truly classical Christian education seeks 3 and 4. Detail is when we know the fact, truth, or concept so that we can readily explain, prove, and illustrate it. Okay? And the fourth one is the one that we should aim for. And we aim for it as teachers, first and foremost. And I'll be honest, I don't have a vivid knowledge of all the stuff I teach. And I know that I'm up here trying to teach others how to teach. But we're still working. We've been, you know, I wasn't given a vivid education when I was young, and so I'm still trying to catch up. But that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get a vivid knowledge so that we can pass this on to our students. Gregory says this, mounting, referring to vivid, mounting to the highest grade of knowledge, we may so know and vividly see a truth in its deeper significance and wider relations that its importance, grandeur, or beauty impresses and inspires us. Okay? When a truth can inspire us, impress us, that's when we have this vivid knowledge. The definition of vivid is producing a strong or clear impression on the senses, producing distinct mental images. That's what we're trying to do in the math class. We're trying to give them a strong or clear impression on the senses. I want to go through real quick just kind of an overview of how this might apply to something like the quadratic formula. Here, the recognition would be, I write it on the board, and some kid goes, "Oh, isn't that the quadratic formula?" Okay, that's the recognition. Recall is when they can actually give it back to you. Okay, you don't have to write it on the board. You can ask them, and they give it to you. The detail is when they know, and this is where we lose it. And I've taught many concepts before, where I've taught them to get an answer at the end, right? But they don't know, what do these numbers that pop out at the end mean, right? What does this refer to? The detail is when they can say something like, "Mr. Edwards, a quadratic equation has two solutions called roots. The quadratic formula is the method whereby we find these solutions. The solutions can be real solutions or complex. In reference to the graph of the quadratic equation, it informs us where the parabola crosses the x-axis, the x-intercepts. The key to knowing what kind of solutions will result can be found in the discriminant, b squared minus 4ac. If the discriminant is positive, Mr. Edwards, then there are two distinct positive real number roots. If the discriminant is zero, then it has one distinct real root, sometimes called a double root. If the discriminant is negative, then there are no real roots, but two distinct complex roots." Okay? That's getting more at the detail, where they can explain to you what this is used for. The vivid is when they can explain its nature in detail, can illustrate its derivation. Okay? I think that they need to be able to derive the quadratic. Where is it coming from? Okay, how is this isn't just out of left field, and we teach this sometimes. Just start right here. Here it is, and let's find out how to plug some numbers in. They need to be able to derive it. They need to be able to apply it to a wide variety of word problems and explain the practical applications. That's more of a vivid knowledge. So how do we cultivate this vivid knowledge? A truth can be fully seen only in the light of other truths. Don't teach math in a vacuum. Okay? Context too often is ignored in a manner that does not allow our students to fully see and understand truth. Why trigonometry? What forced this math to come about? Okay? What were they doing? They were looking up at the stars. They were looking up into the heavens. This looking required them, if they wanted to make observations and find out truths about the stars, they had to develop a math called trigonometry. What is the context to something like Pascal's triangle? Okay, who was he? What motivated his discoveries? All this context, the history of math, needs to be in our curriculum. Okay, we need to bring in the history of math and teach it surrounding our ideas. When we don't do that, there's a vacuum. They don't know the context of these discoveries of the mathematical truths they're learning. In geometry, any study of a geometric idea should be most studies. I don't know, you don't have to do it every time. But when we're looking at geometry, we need to connect this to classical Greek geometry. We need to be bringing up the names of Archimedes and Euclid, Diophantus. All these people need to be coming up in our conversation in geometry. When we look at cubic functions, okay, we should, as soon as we start looking at cubic functions, in algebra, we should be talking about the Italian algebraists. Okay, how did the solution to the cubic, how was that figured out? Talk about folks like Tartaglia and Cardano. When we're doing probability, okay, we should also look at Cardano, Pascal, Fermat. All had significant contributions, and it came about in the 1500s, and they started looking at a thing called the problem of points. Okay, and that, the idea was, if you were in a gambling game, and, you know, the first one to win 11 times is the winner, and maybe you put $100 down, okay? And if you got 8-3, and then, you know, I don't know, an emergency arose, and one of the guys had to leave, how do you distribute the money, $100? How do you distribute it correctly, okay? And then what they started doing is they started looking at probability, and they started asking questions, and they started figuring out probability theory. Sequences and series, Newton, Euler, and Gauss, all are people we should look at when we're looking at that. So please don't teach math in a vacuum. Provide the necessary context. I've edited this, so this is kind of John Milton Gregory and a little bit of Brett Edwards in here, but mostly him. The earnest feelings of mathematical truths clearly and grandly conceived helps convert in the mind of a student the subject of algebra from a tedious and laborious process to a wonderfully ordered museum. Geometry from a logical nightmare to a grand edifice of truth and reason. The calculus from an unintelligible abstraction to a fantastically effective mechanism explaining a mathematical world. When we do that, I believe that's what's happening. The law of the math teacher cultivating these four layers of knowledge, I'm going to give you four. And if you phase out and lose it sometime during the next 45 minutes, try to remember these four. I think I'm going to kind of come back to these four. We need to consolidate our curriculum and dig deeper. We are spreading ourselves so thin, and we're going an inch deep. We need to go deeper with the important ideas in mathematics. If you're to maybe get a few things, one of the things I like you to do is maybe you're meeting next week, 2 weeks from now, with your math, with your group of math teachers back at your school. I want you to pick up your book and start tearing out some pages. Okay. What's that movie? The Robin Williams movie where he's tearing out pages out of the book, right? We need to start doing that. What's happening is modern math curriculum, every time they do a new book, they're thinking, let's add a few more sections, a few more ideas. And what ends up happening is they feel like there's some sort of pressing need to prepare our kids for whatever, standardized tests or whatever, and there's too much. There's just too much information that we're trying to cover in a year. Take it out, consolidate, and dig deeper into the main major ideas that you want them to learn. We need to develop engaging and participatory lectures. You know, part of this is just your responsibility as a teacher to be learning, to be growing as a teacher, to be incorporating what you learn into your lectures. Participatory means you don't go to the board and just tell them how to do a problem. This is a cardinal sin in classical Christian education that you cannot just go up to a board and just say, then do this, then do this, then do this. I've developed this over the 10 or 11 years I've been teaching, but if I were to take a video of myself teaching, I'd be surprised at how much I don't teach. All I'm doing is asking questions. All I'm doing is asking questions. Question, 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 question. Just trying to direct their thoughts, and they're telling me how to do it. And they're teaching themselves. So participatory lectures. We need more effective assessment. And I'm going to talk about this, but our assessment I think is in dire need of reforming. So I'll get back to that one. We need creative exercises, explorations, and investigations. Sometimes math class needs to seem like a science lab. They're going into an experiment. They're doing all kinds of exercises, engaging all their senses. Okay, their physical, their mental senses, and all that. And I'm going to go through one that I did this year that my principal actually referred me to this book called Sacred Geometry. I think the last name is Lundy. I'm not sure if any of you have this small little kind of coffee table book, but this is a church window. This is one of our excursions here. I have three of these. This is a church window in the Isle of Man. I think it's in Ireland. And when we go through this, many teachers just call this impractical. How, is this going to be on a standardized test? No. The church window at the Isle of Man is not going to be there. But this gets at, I think, the heart of learning. What it does, it excites the passion of your students. It cultivates vivid knowledge. All right. What's the theological idea here? Who can tell me the theological idea? This is in a church window in the Isle of Man. It's pretty hopeless. Okay, good. Obviously, it's the Trinity, right? So when we're going to do a construction, if you've come to... I did some seminars last year. If you came to my seminars, I've taught geometry more than any other subject. I'll try not to bias the whole talk with geometry. So there's a lot of this stuff in here. But in my process, in my geometry class, my kids use compass and straight edge at least 3 to 4 days a week, constantly using compass, straight edge, constantly constructing, proving. What I did with my students this year is we went through the construction of this. If this is dealing with the Trinity, what geometric shape do you think is going to be prominent in our construction of this church window? Triangle, right? And what kind of triangle? Equilateral triangle. Well, let me go through. I'm going to try to do step by step. If you get lost here, the notes will be later. But first, you start off describing a circle. Okay. What we do is we then pick a point at the top and produce a line through the center point down to the bottom. We then construct an equilateral triangle. This is proposition 1-1 in Euclid's Elements. And we construct, hopefully you guys can see this, these light gray lines. We construct that and produce a line to the opposite side. We cut it up into a hexagonal. Then we join the points to make our equilateral triangle. We inscribe a circle inside of the triangle. We extend from, if you can see the intersection point of the circle and the line going from top to bottom, we put the compass on the center point there and describe three more circles like so. We can then construct the equilateral triangle inside here. Some of these steps, again, it's a little difficult to see how what's going on here, but we extend again from that center point and do three more circles. We do an outer circle. And then we have to do these three small circles. I don't know if you can see those that end up on the three corners of the big equilateral triangle. And we do another third circle right there. And this, I believe, finishes up. And you can then color in your lines. And this is the construction allowing us to see how we could do this. And you might think, you know, how in the world can kids follow this? It's amazing how well they can follow it, and it's amazing how well your brighter students are going to be able to tell you the next step. Oh, we're going to put it on this point right here, and we're going to describe this circle, and they start leading through. This engages their senses. This is math. Okay, just because it doesn't have any numbers, we need to get away from thinking this is not mathematics. All right, the law of the math student, our next law here. The math student must attend with interest to the fact or truth to be learned. This is, as we've learned, if you've taught for a while, I think I came into teaching thinking it was all about me. If I could just perfect the lesson plan and just be wild enough and, you know, throw my hands around and do stuff, learning would be crammed into their head. And it just didn't happen, okay? The student has a responsibility. The parent has a responsibility. And we cannot, we need to preach this to our students and tell them they do have a responsibility. They must attend with interest. Now, as parents, or as teachers, Most of us have children as well, and I have now a 15-month-old baby girl, and at some point she'll be in school as well. And it's going to be probably a temptation for me to forget that I'm also a parent, okay? And most of you guys are also parents as well. And I would encourage you guys to remember your responsibility as a parent in helping them attend with interest to the fact or truth to be learned. How can this a law apply to us? Well, as teachers, we need to understand that there are two classes of attention that our students have. There's two classes, two areas where we can gain the attention of our students. The first is compelled. Compelled attention is the effort of the will in obedience to command. Okay, this can be attained with an angry face and a pointed finger. Okay, so we can do this. Threats and loud noises, throwing things at them might gain their attention. But this attention doesn't necessarily create a spirit desiring to learn. The second class of attention is the one we really want to think about. That is attracted attention. This springs from desire and is given without conscious effort. The infrequent wow from disinterested Johnny is a sign you've achieved this. And this happens every once in a while, right? That kid that is really not interested, all of a sudden you see him look at, you know, he's with you, okay? This is attracted attention. Students do not learn, obviously, by osmosis or words floating through the air, okay? Teachers that think this are a dime a dozen. I've seen this through my 10, 11 years. There's nothing wrong. I know there's a time and a place to say something like, well, I told you in class, or I said it, or it was on a study guide, and so on. And I know sometimes you did it with the right spirit and they didn't learn it. But just because it was said in class doesn't mean that they were attending to your words. Math instruction ought to be aimed as an arrow at the soul of the learner. Flamed arrows that spark interest, wonder, and enjoyment. Modern math education is merely the cramming of mathematical truths, processes, and concepts. Modern math curriculum is just trying to take a whole bunch of ideas, put it into a machine with the output at the end. Okay? That's not what we're trying to do. So, as we think of this idea of attracted attention, we need to think about sources of interest. What's going to gain their interest? We need to engage all their senses. Movement. Okay? I have what I call a geometry drill team, okay, that I do with the students. They stand up, okay, and we just go through even things as basic as, you know, equilateral triangle, and they do this equilateral triangle with their arms, and they're going through all these different things. They do all kinds of theorems, bodily, movement, touch, visual, auditory, building, constructing, okay? Gregory says, the orator's gesturing hand, his smiling or passion-laden look, and his many-toned voice, all mere addresses to the senses, often do more to wake the minds and hold the attention of his auditors than all the meanings of his speech. Okay? Just talking about the art of teaching, right? We're doing more. There's more to teaching than putting the right words one after the next. Our math curriculum, whatever you use, Saxon, Jacobs, Forrester, it's not enough. It's not sufficient to create the feast of learning that we should want. You guys need to get outside the box. I need to get outside the box and do different objects, investigations, and so on. The second thing to source of interest is new ideas. Be careful in your teaching to bore the senses of your students. Inspire with intrigue. Challenge them. Give them challenge problems. Challenge you to get this by the end of the week. I have a riddle of the week. The first 5 or 10 minutes of my class, I do a different thing every day. Okay. On Monday they come in, we have a riddle. On Tuesday I have a thing called Pick Your Poison. Okay. And Pick Your Poison is a game that's always slanted towards Mr. Edwards. Okay. One of the games is, I think I might have mentioned it last year if you saw it, but there's something called non-transitive dice. Okay. There's three dice, a blue, a red, and a green. And I go, and they have weird numbers on them. Okay. And one of them has 5 4s and a 1. One has 3 3s and 3 6s. I go, forgetting them now, but they have different weird numbers on them. What's crazy about these non-transitive dice is I allow them, I go, hey, you get to pick first. Pick one of these dice. We're going to do a best 2 out of 3 rolling. Okay? And I let them pick first. Well, whatever dice they pick tells me which one I'm going to pick because the probability of each one winning against the other goes in a circle. Okay, it's like rock, paper, scissors. All right, and so what I do is I go, hey, which one do you want to pick? And they think, oh, I got to pick first, right? That's the negative. Okay, you don't want to pick first. So they pick a dice, and then I pick one, and I do lose sometimes, and they think they've done some skilled thing. But pick your poisons on Tuesday, and there's different games. They're always slanted towards me. The third day, on Wednesday, we do a mathematician of the week and a quote of the week. Okay, so I talk about a mathematician and a great quote related to mathematics. The fourth day, we do another riddle, a riddle of the week, and the fifth day we do a game called Quarto. Try to do a quick game of, if some of you guys know, there's a board game called Quarto, and they get to play Mr. Edwards, and if they win, they get a piece of candy. So what we're doing, new ideas, always stretching them to think. Okay. The next one is startling questions. I think maybe even a better way to say it is just thought-provoking questions. Questions that are going to provoke thought. I was listening to one of the ACCS seminars by John Mays. Many of you have probably heard him and maybe get his newsletters. John Mays talks about how he does it. I think it's a great idea. He gives a question at the end of the day. Okay, at the end of the day, he gives a question. And then he says, I want you to answer this. This is a part of your homework. Bring in your answer at the end of the day. And these questions are thought-provoking questions, and then they come in the next day, and they collaborate. They work together. They're discussing what is the answer. And I'm going to go through now what could be some of these questions that you might give. This is another excursion. Some of the fun things that I talk about with my students. Let's say we were given an option, okay? Some of you might have heard this. If I posed a question to a student, I said this, hey, listen, you have a choice. I can give you $10,000 on the first, let's just say it's January 1st. I'm going to give you $10,000 today, or option B, and no money the rest of the month, okay? Option B is I'll give you a penny on the first day. And then I'll give you two pennies on the second, four on the third, eight on the fourth, and keep doubling it, okay? And what would you rather have? Would you rather have, and you get all the money for 31 days. I need to explain this a little bit better. So the first option is $10,000 on day one, nothing else. The second option is a penny on the first, two pennies, keep doubling it, and you get all the money left over. Well, what do the students usually say? Give me the $10,000, right? Okay, I want that $10,000. Well, they've made a poor choice. Why? Because if we look at this, this is an exponential. You can relate this when you're talking about exponents. This is an exponential relationship where to find out how much we're going to get, we do 2 to the 0 power times 0.01, 2 to the 1 power, 2 squared, 2 cubed, and so on. So the question is, what is 2 to the 30th times 0.01? Well, that's about $10 million. Okay, so they missed out on $10 million for one day. Okay. The day before that, they got, you know, 5 million. So this is something where you ask it at the end of the day. You don't give them the answer, right? You ask it, and you come in the next day, and then you have them arguing out, right? And you have a lot of kids saying, "Just take the 10,000 and run," right? No, they should go for option B. Another question might be something like this: you're flying from New York to Madrid. They're about on the same latitude line here. Is this the fastest route, or what is the fastest route, right? This would be good in a geometry class. And so they go back, come back, yeah, of course. Euclid says, the quickest way from a point to another point is a straight line. Well, they're thinking two-dimensionally. We need to think three-dimensionally, right? We're on a sphere, okay? We need to think of great circles, okay? And kids realize this now on the modern plane, right, when you're in the plane. Why aren't we going straight there, right? They're looking at the route going like that, okay? Well, they're following the great circle, okay? That is the fastest way from point A to point B on a sphere. But when you try to place our sphere onto a map, okay, you're dealing with it. The better way to think about it is latitude lines don't give us a great circle. Longitude lines do. So if you're thinking longitudinally, you would follow the longitude lines. But in latitude, you don't. You need to find the great circle. So this is another one. This one I found at a great website. I've referred to it before in other seminars. grandillusions.com. I love this website. It's just got toys and tricks and games, and they're not super heavy math or anything like that, but there's some that just have a great, you know, mathematical connection. This one is called Endless Landscapes. What you've been given are 24, and I have some of these in my class. You have 24 cards, but they make up a landscape, but they're totally interchangeable. You can move them around however you want, and it creates a different landscape, right? So the question might be for your students, how many potential landscapes are there, right? You have 24 cards, and you're going to get some kids, and I think there's like 140, you know, or, and they're coming, I think there's like 1,000, right? Well, this is a question that if you wanted to, you know, go ahead and solve it, you would do this maybe in an algebra, upper level algebra pre-calculus class. It's a combinations question. It's a factorial question, okay? 24, 4, factorial. So if you ever want to keep them busy, right, and you need to grade some tests, give them the endless landscapes and say, okay, do all the different combinations, and if you haven't finished, don't talk to me. But so these endless landscapes are a great idea, a great picture of a mathematical principle. This is the isoparametric problem. I don't know if I'm going to give the story as well as I should, but in classical mythology, Princess Dido supposedly landed on the northern coast of Africa. Okay, we are told in the Aeneid that she was given the hide of a bull, and whatever she could enclose with the hide would become hers. Basically, the hide of a bull, I need to read the Aeneid and figure out the context of that. But whatever she could, you know, take the hide of the bull and surround would then become hers. And so she ended up doing this, and then the mythology is that this became Carthage, the great city of Carthage. Well, the question came up, what geometric shape with equal perimeter would enclose the largest area with the hide? Okay, let me put the problem another way. You're on this boat here, you're floating in, and you arrive, and some leader in this area says, hey, I'm going to give you this rope, okay, I'm going to give you 100 miles of it, and using the shore as one of your borders, and we're going to call it Arclid, okay, reference to our classical Greek mathematicians. How would you arrange this rope to enclose the greatest amount of area? Send that home with the kids. They come back in. Well, would it be maybe some sort of rectangular area? Is that going to enclose the greatest amount? Maybe a semicircle. Would that do it? A square. And you can talk about all these possibilities and discuss them and go back and forth with them. And this became a problem for ancient mathematicians, the Greeks, and they ended up determining that the correct answer is a semicircle. So these are all questions, again, that can cause your students to think, and then you can explore the whys, why it does that. Another question is, if you were to take a chain, this is called the catenary problem. This would be a good one maybe for a trigonometry class. If you were to take a chain and hang it from A to B, from A and from B, how would it hang? Would it hang as a parabola? Send them home, they come back, and they start debating it. Well, the answer is no, okay? It hangs as what we call a catenary. And this catenary has connections to a trigonometric function. And if you flip it upside down, it looks a lot like a landmark in the United States. What's the landmark is that? It's the arch, okay? And the question is the arch a parabola or a catenary? And it's a catenary, okay? If you were to do all the math and figure it out, that could be another exploration for your students. I think a fun one that gets into kind of the twilight zone here, if you're doing in geometry class and you're studying just right triangles and you were to look at a square with side lengths 1, what is the length of the diagonal? And you might walk through this one with them. Well, then you send home and go, okay, you know what the diagonal of a square is. Right? What about the diagonal of a cube? Right? And this is something now, again, you're not telling them, But you're seeing, can they apply what they've just learned, all right? And they need to recognize, we learned that the diagonal of a square is root 2, and we know that the square has a side length of 1, so now we're not using 1 and 1, we're using 1 and root 2, okay? Well, you could go another day and ask them the diagonal of what's called a hypercube, okay? Now, this is the twilight zone because we're now not in the third dimension. We're in the fourth dimension. So the question is, what's the length of that diagonal? And you can actually find out this weirdly fictitious number. And if you want to try to figure it out and come talk to me later, I'll tell you what we think the diagonal length of a hypercube is. Another question is a question encountered by the great Leonard Euler. The city of Königsberg, now called Kaliningrad in Russia, they had a question, they had a debate. What they're wondering is, man, we do these tours of the city. Is there any way we can do a tour of Königsberg and cross all the bridges only once? Okay, so you send a map home with the kids, and they're trying to figure it out, and they're doing all these lines and going through. And Leonard, they determined basically that it can't be done. Okay, this is and when Leonard Euler approached this problem, he approached it in nodes, and he came up with an answer. Basically, the essence of the answer is we have four different locations, A, B, C, and D, and each one has even number bridges going out. Okay, they all have odd number bridges. Sorry, and because of that, okay, they can't. There's no way that you can do that. And there's ways you could add bridges. You could even make a lesson go, where could we add a bridge so that we could do that? And then this is another Twilight Zone one. This is, if some of you guys have studied Georg Cantor and the study of set theory, infinite sets, you could ask the question, basically the question being, think of the real numbers between 0 and 1, and then think of all the real numbers on the real number line. Which is greater, the real numbers between 0 and 1, okay, or the real numbers on the whole number line? Are they greater, equal, less than, and so on? And there has to be an assumption here. This gets to a word called cardinality. Basically, the question is asking, another way to ask the question, can each real number on the real number line be matched up in a one-to-one correspondence with the numbers between 0 and 1? If so, then they have a quote-unquote what's called an equal cardinality. And just a simple illustration, this is what's kind of weird about it, the amount of real numbers between 0 and 1 is equal to the amount of real numbers on the real number line. And that's what's so fun about math a lot of times, counterintuitive answers. But when we look at a very simple illustration, we'll see how this can be proved to be true. Let's say we were to take that line from 0 to 1 and just lift it up to AB. Okay? And let's describe a circle there. Well, just pick any point. In our case, we're going to pick 1/4. And we're now going to draw a line from that red point to the center. And then what we're going to do is, where it intersects the circle, we're going to draw a line perpendicular to that diameter. That's point one. Okay? Well, let's just pick another point. Two. We do it again. It has a corresponding point P2. Okay? Let's just take -3. We do another blue line to our center point. And then we draw our green line perpendicular to the diameter. That's point three. Well, you start seeing a pattern here. Every red point has a corresponding yellow point. It has a one-to-one correspondence. What about -5 billion? Well, that one's coming in from over here, right? Okay. And that's P4. Okay. And there's a one-to-one correspondence. So the amount of real numbers between 0 and 1 is equal to the amount of real numbers on the entire number line. These are all great questions, causing your students to think. It's creating, I believe, the wow factor that really creates the wonder and gives them the impression that we're seeking to create in our students. The law of the language of math. The language of math used in teaching must be common to teacher and learner. Language, the system of linguistic signs or symbols considered in the abstract. Is that not math, right? This is the definition, again, of just language. I didn't look up language, parentheses, math. The system of linguistic signs are symbols considered in the abstract. Math is a foreign language our students learn. And hopefully it won't be so foreign to them. Sadly, it continues. William Blake says this about language. Blake wrote, "I have heard many people say, 'Give me the ideas. It is no matter what word you put them into.' To this he replies, 'Ideas cannot be given but in their minutely appropriate words.'" The point being, some of our students just tell me how to get the answer, right? You know, sometimes I'm in the middle and they're just like, "Ms. Rhodes, I had a teacher a few years ago and they did it way quicker than this, okay? You know, just give me the way to get it, okay? Just tell me how to pump out answer." And they're missing the point that the ideas cannot be given without the minutely appropriate words. I think the poor math teacher, or the math teacher that's not doing a good job with this law, can be compared to maybe an American in Italy who, when asking directions, right? They're asking it in English, of course, and they receive a weird look from an Italian. And what do? They talk louder and slower, okay? And wondering why this Italian is not getting it, okay? That's not the problem. The problem is the Italian doesn't speak English. Some of our students don't speak the language of math. So I want to talk about three areas where we can improve this. The grammar school is, if you're a grammar level teacher, this is a huge place where you can take away something from this session. Huge place. Students need to learn the grammar of math early. They need to learn the terms that they'll be using in the logic and rhetoric school. These words like integers, okay, natural numbers, expression, equation, all these terms can be taught at the grammar level. I think sometimes we have a very high expectation in a lot of areas in the grammar level, but our expectation of language in the math area is struggling. They need to develop a vast vocabulary of math terms. This is when we talk about it a lot in classical Christian education. They are sponges at this age. Okay, take advantage of it as grammar level teachers. Give them these terms, and this is going to take collaboration. We're going to have to collaborate all together from kindergarten through 12th grade, talking teachers. Okay, what terms do I need to teach? And my school has been great. Our teachers have said, what terms? Give us the terms. You know, give us the 5 to 10 mathematicians that you would really want them to know about. Okay, and so it takes collaboration to do this. I would say one of the great emphases of a logic school in terms of the language of math is they're learning to justify. What they're doing is they're now taking their math terms and putting them into sentences and putting them into. This is so key to math. How to justify results? They just need to, in those years, in the logic years, that needs to be hammered home alongside of logic classes and so on. They need to learn how to justify everything they do. Why? I know that's the answer. Okay, how'd you get that? Okay, tell me with the right words. And I constantly am stopping my students. No, yes, that's correct, but you didn't say it right. Okay, I've been thinking about things. You know, if you have like think up here 5 and just a divisor and 20. How many times do I have students that go 5 divided by 20 is 4? Right? I'm like, no, 5 divided by 20 is not 4. And it, just because I know that you have it, the answer you have is right for what they're doing. Okay? I go, no, that's wrong. You've said it incorrectly. Oh, yeah. Because they're reading left to right, right? That's what they've been taught. So they just go, 5 divided by 20 is 4. No, 20 divided by 5 is all the way they word it, right? You know, so many times in class when I'm asking, I say, so what do we do next? Well, so many times our students do what? They don't tell us what to do. They just tell us the answer, right? Well, it's 3x. No. Add like terms. That's what we're doing next, okay? So the language is important. And in the rhetoric school, we're to articulate math arguments persuasively. Don't divide our math classes from classical Christian education. We are trying to create articulate, winsome, well-speaking students in the math class who can take math arguments and use them convincingly. I got a term last year from Linda Janikowski in her sessions. We're trying to produce a math rhetorician. Okay, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to do more again than just do processes and steps and so on. The next law is the law of the math lesson. The mathematical truth to be taught must be learned through mathematical truth already known. I like this this one again. The student's up here, and the teacher says, I think you should be more explicit here in step two. And I've seen this often in my class where it says, then a miracle occurs. So they missed a truth along the way, obviously. There are two ditches of the math lesson. The two ditches are too slow and too fast. Gregory says this about too slow. To teach again what is already known and understood is to mock the pupil's desire for knowledge and to deaden his power of attention by compelling him to walk the weary round of a treadmill. Old minds may be reworked if you can find ore at deeper levels. Okay, so when there's ore at deeper levels, go to that mine again, but don't just keep doing the same thing. The moving too fast, this is what Gregory says, till this starting point in the familiar is found, he knows it is useless to go on. As well bid one to follow you through a winding way in the pitch darkness without first letting him know where you are putting him in the path. Okay, so don't go too slow, don't go too fast. Well, this needs a little bit of elaboration. Here's a few ideas, and I'm going to repeat again. Consolidate your curriculum. In order to do this, we go too fast because we feel like we have too much to do. Okay? I'm constantly, every year I'm pressured. I've been told now for years to do what I'm saying right now, and I'm still pressuring. It's like understanding the sovereignty of God and worrying. We do that all the time. We worry, yet we profess the sovereignty of God. Okay? Same way in the math class. I know, dig deeper, don't do this, and I do that, but we got to throw out unnecessary material. Don't set a precedent of for your students that they're only accountable for exact problems that you've done in class. This is one of the most frustrating things I deal with my students, which is this. There was a problem in the test that wasn't on in the homework. There was a problem in the test, and it's like, it's just because, you know, an x squared was switched with an x. It's frustrating. And what happens is the reason why they're getting that is because in modern math education, we think we can only hold them responsible for exact, you know, cookie cutter problems that we've taught them how to do. The point here, again, don't throw the calculus problem in on the geometry test, okay? That's not what I'm asking. But what we're trying to do is we are trying to create people that can solve problems, okay? We're not trying to create little imitation factories that can learn a bunch of steps and just this is what Mr. Edwards does and this is what I do and get right answer. We're trying to create problem solvers that can encounter fresh problems and use the thinking skills that they've learned to do this. This is why word problems are good, because they do require the student to a new different problem. The goal is knowledge retention. I would encourage you to listen. I think it was last year John Mays gave a seminar and talked a lot more about this than I'm going to talk about it. But he says, and I think it's tough for me to think how I'm going to implement this, but hold students accountable for everything they've been taught the whole year. Okay. If you teach it the first day, they're accountable for it third quarter. They're accountable for it fourth quarter. And I'm just thinking, how do I do that? That's the goal. I don't know. It might not happen for you this year. But what he's saying is basically, we're not just, he calls it the learn, pass, forget. Okay. Learn, pass, forget. That's what we do. We got, okay, don't worry. This won't be on the next test. There's a few different things he did. And again, I refer you to his seminar, but he talks about giving a problem sheet at the beginning of the year, problems from, not the whole book of problems, right? But just the essential problems that you want them to know. I don't know, maybe 50, 60. And as you go through those different lessons, they are then accountable for those, you know, maybe those problems and similar problems and fresh problems on those ideas. And so he has, and it's, there's, he says on his test, every test, again, I haven't done this, so, but I think it's a great idea. On every test, he's giving problems from before. You're accountable for this. I taught it to you because I thought it was important. I taught it to you because I thought you needed to remember it. Okay? The goal is knowledge retention. And we need to empower our parents. Don't let your parents off the hook. They are responsible. They are ultimately the ones responsible for their child's education. Make this clear at the beginning of the year. Tell them how your system works. Give it to them in detail. This is how it works. Okay? I have a sheet that I give them. Basically, I kind of have mapped out the different assignments I'm going to give them. And, you know, let's be honest, parents, one of the things parents are most interested in, this is probably a negative, but our grades, right? What's the grade? And I say, you know, your students are going to have this sheet. I'm going to give them a grade. I'm going to tell them, you know, they put it on this sheet. I don't need to tell you when your student gets a poor grade. Okay, it's on this sheet. Now, I'm not saying that's the best system. I'm just saying that I tell them that's my system. That system, this is how it works. You guys can know what their grades are at all times. I tell them, you could figure out their exact to the, you know, hundredth decimal point what their grade is, okay? Because sometimes we get the, I didn't even know they were failing, or, you know, I didn't know they were getting a C or something like that. Well, we talked about this at the beginning of the year. Empower the parents. Tell them how the system works. Law of teaching math. Excite and direct the self-activities of the math student. Tell him nothing that he can learn himself. Let me make first the distinction between this, the law of teaching math and law of the teacher. Law of the teacher is describing the qualifications of the math teacher. This is describing the necessary function of the math teacher. One of the greatest skills we're going to create in our classroom is the skill of creativity. We want to create imaginative, creative minds. Again, problem solvers are usually creative. There are two aspects to this law. Excite the creativity and imagination of the student. How do we do this? We arouse the spirit. We cultivate curiosity. We reveal wonder. There's more to that. We train the student to find truth independently. And we've already talked about that before. So, how do we do these two things? There are two chief springs of interest that Gregory talks about. There's a love of knowledge as a means of mental satisfaction, and there's a desire of knowledge as a means of obtaining other satisfactions. Okay? Many times we're too focused on number two. What is this going to get us? Right? And I often tell the story of Euclid and his student. The student says, what's the purpose of what I'm learning in here? Okay, and Euclid turns to his servant and says, give this boy a penny. He desires to profit from all that he learns. And what Euclid, and the Greeks are notorious for, we don't care for its practical application. Okay, now I think this needs to be, I've already talked about it, practical application needs to be there. But there needs to be a love of knowledge as a means of mental satisfaction. Love of knowledge for itself. Okay? We're learning truth in here, and it's not just important because it gets me from point A to point B. This is the third excursion I want to talk about. This is called the Brachistochrone problem, and this is, again, cultivating, arousing the spirit, revealing wonder. The Brachistochrone problem was a problem encountered by Johann Bernoulli. He was a part of the Bernoulli family, seven prominent mathematicians from the Bernoulli family, probably the most famous mathematician family. They were also a very cantankerous, bickering group, not real pleasant to be around. Johann Bernoulli had basically developed the question, if you have a point A and a point B, and you have a, let's just call it a ball, right? What's the route of fastest descent for this ball? To get from A to B, what would be the curve or line that would get it from A to B the fastest? Well, we might just think a straight line. Well, Johann Bernoulli was studying this and found out it's not. To get from there, it is not. The quickest way is not from one point to the next, a straight line in this case. So the question he was trying to answer is, what will get my ball from A to B fastest? And it's a mathematical question. So he finds out the answer, but he wants to make it a challenge. And this is what we could do in our class. Again, he's doing what we do as teachers, we should do as teachers in our class. So he challenges people in a mathematical journal back in the 1600s and says, I challenge anyone, try to find out what is the curve that will be the route of fastest descent here. And then he also gave a he gave more information and said, it's not a straight line. Okay, he gave this, I think, in June of 1696, and he gives this problem. And by the end of the year, only one person had submitted an answer, and that was the great Leibniz. But Leibniz says, hey, I don't think everyone got word of this. So let's extend the deadline to Easter. So he extends the deadline to Easter, and there was a great rivalry between the continental mathematicians and the British mathematicians, and this is at the time of the great Isaac Newton. And they make a specific note to send to Isaac Newton. Probably they didn't like him. They're probably wanting to stump him. You can't figure this out. Okay. Well, the story goes that Newton was busy working at the Mint in London, and he received it. He got home at 4 p.m. and stayed up all night, and at 4 a.m. he had the answer. And a lot of people refer back and go, that just shows he was getting old at that time. Okay, it took him that long to get the answer. So by the time Easter came, there were 5 people that had responded correctly to this. So again, the question is, would this be the fastest? You know, AM1B. Well, we should obviously rule that one out. It's probably not going to be our best choice. But then the question is, what about this curve? This one right here is a circle. Okay, that's a portion of a circle. And it's none of these. Okay, the actual answer is what's called a cycloid curve. Okay, and the cycloid curve comes, if you think of a wheel, put a point on a wheel, follow that point as it rotates. That's what a cycloid curve. And this is a great problem for a trigonometry pre-calculus class to get over. It has trigonometric functions embedded in here. What's great about the story, it was sent to Newton. He gets the answer, but he sends in his answer anonymously. Okay, so he's like, I don't have time to put my name on this. So he sends it in, and Bernoulli gets it, and you know it's obviously from London. And this is what he says, a great compliment to the great Newton. He goes, I recognize the lion by his paw. All right, and that was very complimentary. Newton wasn't so complimentary. He says, I do not like to be teased about mathematical things by foreigners. So the law of learning math. The math student must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be acquired. 5 stages of learning: memorize the concept, understand concept clearly, translate concept into words, seek evidences of concept, study uses and applications of concept. No learning is complete until these 5 stages are completed. We need to reform our assessment. Assess creatively. We need to have a heavy emphasis on oral presentation. Constantly they're speaking orally in your class. But there needs to be some sort of, I think, it's a little more difficult to do this, but how do we assess their learning on what they're saying, the words coming out of their mouths? We need to use a variety of assessment tools. On virtually all my geometry tests, part of their assessment is a compass and straight edge. They're actually having to construct something, and then I'm telling them with that construction to answer questions. Okay, you know, there's a wide variety of things. I do flow proofs where I give them an envelope, and it has the different statements and reasons, and they have to take tape. This is on a test. And they're taping this flow proof on a piece of paper. But these are all, it's more difficult, it's more time consuming, but assessment needs to be to grow. One of those assessments is what I talked about earlier. We need to assess all of learning throughout the year. Another person I've learned a lot from is a man named Dale Siegenthaler. He's a teacher up at Veritas. I've listened to some of his seminars. One of his ideas is, I think he gives a test where every answer is 2, and he gives them the answer at the beginning. Every answer to this 20-question test is 2. Okay, tell me how I got there. Right, and so the point isn't what's the answer. The point is how'd you get from there to there. And I think it's a fantastic idea. We also need to weigh the material that best assesses their acquisition of knowledge, and this has been something I've learned the hard way, but. we need to start weighting tests more. Okay, the modern idea is to weight tests less and less. Okay, because then more students can pass. What's ending up happening is students are figuring out they can fail all the tests and still pass the class. Okay, or still get a B. When we weight the things that truly assess learning, and they're going to start feeling maybe the punishment sooner. I know this has a lot of reverberation. This is going to get parent feedback, right? But we need to start weighing more the things that really assess learning. Okay, John May is, I've referred to him before, but his upper level math and science classes, he gives no, there's no weight to homework. He doesn't give there's no points. You know, why am I doing this? Oh, well, if you want to learn the material, you got to do the homework. And he emphasizes parent communication. All I do is when they don't do their homework, I tell Mrs. Johnson, hey, Johnny hasn't done his homework 2 days in a row. Right. And he says he's had a lot of success with that, but he doesn't wait at all. I haven't got there yet, but I would like to go further in that direction. Homework does not necessarily assess whether they've learned it or not. One of my students this year, she had fantastic homework, but she was doing it with her tutor and terrible on tests. I mean, just horrible. Homework does not always effectively assess whether they're learning it. Another way of assessing is the thought questions. I wasn't planning on doing a whole bunch here, so I'll just kind of, I was going to go over this quick. We should know by now the importance of review. The completion test and confirmation of teaching math must be made by reviews. Three chief aims of review: to perfect knowledge, confirm knowledge, to render knowledge ready and useful. Again, I'm going to zip through here, so if you need this, I'll tell you at the end where you can get these notes. Three main places for review, I think, are introduction of lesson, and conclusion of lesson, but the one that we probably don't do enough is the spontaneous review. I maybe could call this the Peyton Manning review. Peyton Manning's a football player, quarterback, and from what I've seen, he's pretty famous for he's constantly changing plays. He goes up, reads the defense, ooh, they're doing this, I'm going to change it. That's what we need to do as math teachers. Sometimes I just don't know until, they don't even know this yet, okay? That's when maybe review comes into play. Spontaneous review needs to come. You're going to have to stop the lesson plan. It might mess it up, but that's what good review is about. All right, two things to leave you with as we finish up here. Consolidate curriculum and dig deeper. Engaging in participatory lectures. This is done by giving context. More effective assessment. And the last thing, creative exercises, explorations, and investigations. Those four things, if you got nothing else. And the last thing, if you didn't like me at all, let me refer you to some people that you might like. There's a website called Neoclassical Think Tank. I just found out about this recently, but math and science guy, really trying to think about how to teach classically. I think he's out in California. Elizalde. John May has referred to him a lot. Navarre Science and Math. Just go and listen to the math seminars at the ACCS website. Linda Janikowski has some of her seminars up there, and you can listen to the other seven laws of teaching math seminar and compare it to mine and see if he did better. And then these are just a few of the books that I would suggest, to get you started on or continue your journey. All right. We've hit our time, but if you got to leave, I understand. But I will try to take a few questions if someone has questions. Yes. Yeah, please feel free. I know one of the things that really helped me was going to the guy I mentioned earlier, this seminar by Dale Siegenthaler. And sometimes it's a year, but I constantly go back, email, hey, how do you do that? What curriculum do you use for 7th grade? And I want you guys to feel free, if you need someone to bounce ideas off of, to throw me an email. Any other questions? Yes?
A lot of your
characters,
do you have a place where you go to get those?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's been, in the last 3 or 4 years, just lots and lots of books. Let me tell you some good excursion books that would do it. both the Dunham books right here, The Mathematical Universe. This is from my Cobb County Library right here. But Mathematical Universe, you'd be surprised at local libraries what kind of books they have. Journey Through Genius has some good excursions. Another great Martin Gardner. I don't know if you guys know him. He does recreational mathematics, a book called Colossal Book of Mathematics. It took me forever, but it's got some fascinating stuff in there. And another great, or two more, The Drunkard's Walk is a great one for probability. And it's not showing up here, but at the bottom, Simon Singh, Fermat's Enigma. That's a fantastic book, Fermat's Enigma. Yes. Yeah, if you're not book, I have a teaching company. Teaching company has some fantastic stuff, and Dunham just came out with Great Thinkers, Great Theorems, a teaching company DVD series. So I've been watching him a few times last week. I had something else. Lost it. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, if you finish these books, just give me another email. Reading the books is where I've gotten a lot of these fun ideas and so on. Anything else? Yes. At my school, I'm kind of the logic school and rhetoric school math guy, and there's no one else, so I get to make all the decisions. Some of you might be in but from parents, you know, not really. I'm not telling them I'm taking this stuff out and it might be on the standardized test. You know, I'm not telling them that. But that might be what I'm doing to give them a deeper knowledge. But yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, one of the things that a lot of times the ideas I have, I'll say this real quick. Oh, but what's going to happen on a standardized test? I actually think digging deeper, they will actually do better on standardized tests. Okay, I think, you might not have gone over those exact problems, but they're learning the ability to think. And I do think the SAT does, to a certain degree, test your level to think, the math and so on. It does test your ability to think critically. Well, if we're just going over real quick, inch deep, I don't know if they're really getting to think deep. All right, if you have more questions, come up later, find me, but thanks for coming.